This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo. Guishan's great capacity and great function, the main case. Master Guishan said to the assembly, "People nowadays have great capacity, but do not have great function." Yangshan related this to another temple priest. The temple priest kicked over a stool. Hearing about this, Guishan burst into laughter. The commentary. Each and every one is born with the great capacity of a spiritual being. But if this potential doesn't leave its fixed position, it can't impart strength on the road. In the Zen school, in a single word or action, with one entry or exit, one encounter, one response, it becomes clear whether someone is deep or shallow. Guishan wants everyone in his assembly to know this, so he lifts up with one hand and presses down with another. The great function is not found within fixed patterns. If we wish to free what is stuck and loosen what is bound, we must first cut away all traces of thought, take off the blinders, and set down the pack. It's here that the season of great peace becomes freely functional in the midst of chaos and confusion. The priest, hearing of Guishan's teaching, kicks over a stool. Guishan bursts into laughter. What is the meaning of the priest's action and Guishan's laughter? If you want to understand this encounter, you should first understand that a true person of great function cannot even lift a leg. The capping verse. Everywhere, suffering and pain, everyone vainly discussing the self. Though they are Buddha, it's all buried beneath years of conditioning. Well, I bring greetings from the New Zealand Sangha, where I've been for the last couple of weeks. As I mentioned during Open Sozan, this was our 31st year practicing together. And while many folks here may not know much about that Sangha or think about them, they think about us a lot. And stay very connected to what's going on here and within the Sangha here, and feel very much a part of our Sangha as they are. And some of that Sangha is here in this room today, a couple of you, students from the New Zealand Sangha, and many of them have been here over the years. And it's just good to know that. I say that so that we can also be very aware of them and their inclusion in our community. Dal Roshi says, each and every one is born with the great capacity of a spiritual being, but if this potential doesn't leave its fixed position, it cannot impart strength on the road. You know, the Buddha clarified in his own enlightenment this, that we all have this great capacity. So that's never debated. That's never a question. That's never under scrutiny, even, within Buddhist practice. Because that's already been verified. Each of us has great capacity. But do not necessarily have great function. And so Roshi says that if that capacity doesn't leave its fixed position, if this potential, and capacity in a sense is not the same as potential. Capacity is just capacity. We can think of it as having a potential. We can think of whether that potential is being activated or realized. But it's like Buddha nature. Buddha nature is not the potential to have enlightened nature. It's enlightened nature. Our capacity is our capacity. It's our nature. It's who we are. This morning we chanted, the mind of the great sage of India was intimately conveyed from west to east. Among human beings, there are some wise ones and there are some foolish ones. But in the way, there's no northern or southern ancestor. There are no distinct schools of Buddhism. There's no enlightened and deluded. There's no better and worse. And among human beings are wise ones and foolish ones. There is capacity and there is our function. And this is really the essence of Buddhist teaching and practice. It's really what we're here for. It's what we should be here for, is recognizing this great capacity, cultivating faith in that capacity, our Buddha nature, our enlightened nature, practicing within that faith and in accord with that capacity. That's what practice is. When we're practicing in accord with our Buddha nature, practice tends to flow, even when it's difficult. It's difficult, but in a different way, not in the old way. When we don't practice in accord with our Buddha nature, then it's just difficult in the old way. There have always been people who have acted foolishly, selfishly, angrily, violently, and have created all measures of harm. And there have always been people who are selfless and wise and generous and loving, who are great examples and bring inspiration and good things into this world. And what Guishan is saying, Guishan was a 9th century Chinese master. Yangshan was his student. And together they created the Guiyang school, which was one of the prominent schools in that period of Zen. And what they're both, he and Dada Roshi are both saying, that we're all born with this capacity. That was the Buddha's enlightenment. That's what he verified for himself and then presented us with a path by which we can verify the same. And that's true whether we practice or not. It's true before any action is taken, before a word is spoken. And it's not just true of human beings, it's true of everything, animate and inanimate. And so the eternal question that every religious tradition basically has to answer is if this is our endowment and that endowment is different in different traditions, why is there so much suffering? If we are wise in our very nature, why do we act foolishly? If our fundamental self is selfless, then why do we act so selfishly? Like, what's that about? Why do we act against our not only our interests and our desires, but actually against our fundamental nature? And of course, Buddha and Buddhism has 2,500 years of response to that. And so there's the suffering that arises because we seek after, you know, temporary pleasure and seek some ultimate happiness in those fleeting moments. We suffer because of change, because we don't like it. We want things to stay. And we suffer because of the skandhas, which is the more subtle form of suffering, one that we really need to examine. Form, sensation, feeling, our perceptions, all of the machinations of the mind, our mental formations and consciousness, the Buddha said, is dukkha. Which means the very constituent parts that make up what we call the person are themselves dukkha, contain within them the stuff of our disappointment and dissatisfaction. And so we practice not so much to change our inner and outer world, but to realize that how within an eternally ever-changing world, inside and outside, that each of us has to make our own determination. Each of us is making our own determination, which is another way of saying we are creating this life. And that's really sort of a very important thing to appreciate. You know, Buddhism does not ask or demand or require. It's not coercive. It's not compulsory. None of us have to be here. Being here, then there are certain things that are asked. But that's not Buddhism. That's the staff. It's me asking, okay, if we're going to be here doing this thing which is not compulsory, not required, which cannot be coerced, let's make a few agreements about how we're going to do this. But that's such an important part. It's one of the things that really drew me to Buddhism in the beginning, was its clear and incisive and unapologetic presentation of the truth of things. Not shying away, not glossing it over. And at the same time, not being directive. You shall, you must. So when the precepts say, do not be angry, do not steal, they're saying, you can choose to be angry. That's your right. But consider making another choice. Each of us has to work this out. The Buddha said once, students, do give up creating harm. Creating harm can be abandoned. If it weren't possible to do this, I wouldn't say this. Since it can be done, I say give up creating harm. If this giving up led to loss and pain, I wouldn't ask you to give it up. I wouldn't suggest that you do that. I wouldn't say it's possible to do this. Do cultivate all that is good. Good can be cultivated. If it were possible to do so, I wouldn't say it. Since it can be done, I encourage you to cultivate all that is good, since this does lead to your welfare and happiness, yours and others. I encourage you to cultivate all that is good. The rest is left up to each of us. In a sense, that's the extent of the Buddha's power. Now it's in our hands. And so all of our practice, our zazen, our walking, our working, our listening, our sleeping, our speaking, our dying, is to realize this great capacity and to bring it forth as great function. Because just as we have the ability to create good and not create harm, we don't always do that. Just as we have the enlightened nature of Buddha, we don't necessarily practice in accord with that. We don't realize it. The more harm we create in those very actions, in those mind states, we're denying, turning against not only our function, but our capacity, our basic nature. And that's a painful thing. It's just painful to turn against what is true, to turn against our own basic nature as a being in the world. It's like tearing something apart. There's a ripping sound. And the more we do that, the more painful it is. And so we have to do something about that pain. And too often what we do is sort of move off in the wrong direction. We don't cease to do that which is creating the pain, but we just try and make the pain go away by doing more of what's causing it. And the more we do that, the more we bring it upon others. This great capacity within which we can think of as having great potential to live a life that is happy and generous and isn't selfish. I mean, if we just look around, just look anywhere, small and large, and see the harm that's being created, and we will find clinging, we'll find selfishness, we'll find greed and anger, we'll find delusion. So when Yangshan told this story of Guishan saying, speaking about great capacity, everyone has it, but not having great function, he mentioned it to another monastic, and the monastic just kicked over a stool. Dada Roshi said, "This old fellow is acting strange. The tip of his foot has a mind of its own." What is he saying? The tip of his foot has a mind of its own. It's not the priest's doing. And he is responsible. When Guishan heard about this, he burst into laughter. Dada Roshi says, "Guishan takes notice, but say, what realm is this?" And this is where, in these dialogues, in these koans, very often we see what appear to us as very ordinary actions, and they are. But when we see them from our ordinary perspective, we're seeing our ordinary perspective. We're not seeing the great function. We're not seeing the great capacity. And so the koans are inviting us to see in a different way. That's why Dada Roshi is saying this, because he wants to be careful that we don't just pass over this and think, "Oh, this is cute. Ha ha ha." That's not what's happening. What realm is this in which Guishan is laughter? What is selflessness? It's not a place, it's not a time, it's not a person, it's not a thing, it's not an experience, it's not a condition. If it were any of those things, it would ultimately disappoint us. It's free. That's how it's why it's spoken of as a great capacity. And at the same time, it suggests something that is, and also something that can be. Capacity for what? To do what? Selflessness is not the lack of something, which is how we can think of it. That's why language, you know, we have to use it, but we have to, in a sense, retool the language that we use. Retool the language and the meaning of these words that come with certain meaning, which is why we use these words, because they're partly true, but in that very meaning, they're also partly false. And our work is to understand them as true. So selflessness is not the lack of something, right? Because that's often what we think of practice. I have to get rid of that which is self, which is just creating more. So Dada Roshi says, the great function is not found in fixed patterns. If we wish to free what is stuck and loosen what is bound, just cut away all traces of thought. Take off the blinders and set down the pack. And it's interesting that in order to ultimately realize that the nature of thought is free, boundless, thoughts do not bind us. That's why Huainong said, free your thoughts from their bondage. Liberate them. Don't create suffering within your own thoughts. But in order to do that, we have to, as Dada Roshi says, let go of all traces of thought. We have to free ourselves of thought and everything we think about thought in order to realize that thoughts are not a problem. Now, we can think in such a way that is liberated, that is the great function itself. But first, before we can do that, we have to let them drop away. To take off the blinders and set down the pack, we could think of that as all of our karmic obstructions. They too, in and of themselves, are not a problem. Nothing inherently is of the nature of obstruction. And yet, in order to see that, we have to put those obstructions down and realize this great capacity so that we can then, as Dadaroshi says, let this season of great peace function freely in the midst of chaos and confusion, which is really our challenge. Dadaroshi invokes this koan that's in the Gateless Gate, where an old master said, understand that a true person of great function, well, Dadaroshi says, cannot even lift a leg. And in the koan, an old master says, why can't a person of great strength lift up their leg? It's not with their tongue that they speak. So in that koan, the teacher is directly denying what seems to be the truth. Of course a person of great strength can pick up their leg. Of course it's with the tongue that they speak. So why does he say no? What is that no? What is the no of no suffering and no end of suffering? No old age and death and no end to old age and death. They're pointing not at something, but directly at our own heart, at this great capacity. Within the small capacity, we walk, we talk, we think, we act, we respond, we measure, we judge, we evaluate, we build, we destroy. And all along, there's someone who's at the center of it all. As Bodhidharma said, well, there's a commentary to a koan in the Wuman Khan, it says, the troublemaker, after all, is you. Don't you know? Didn't anybody tell you? Right? We keep trying to dodge that. Right? Or if we come in saying, no, I'm the troublemaker. No, not that. That's not what he means. In other words, it's not an expression of self-criticism, a blame. It's just a fact. The troublemaker, after all, is you. The peacemaker, after all, is you. And they're not two of you. Within all of those actions, there's someone who knows, who observes, who measures, who judges. There is distance. There is none of that, all of that activity without that distance. There is no chaos and confusion without distance. And so, in practice, we endeavor to close not the distance, but the sense of distance, the perception of distance, the illusion of distance. Master Dogen, in his fascicle on spiritual powers, said, the spiritual powers, the great capacity, that are thus, that are your very nature in every moment, are the tea and meals of the Buddha family. No Buddhas up to the present have ever neglected or grown tired of them. They cannot be exhausted, this great capacity, this great function. They will never be attained. And we will never meet their limit. They take the 3,000 acts of the morning and the 800 acts of the evening as the state of things. All of our ordinary moments, every action, simple things, getting up, putting on our clothes, laughing, stumbling over a stool. The 3,000 acts and 800 acts of morning and evening are the state of things. They are in and of themselves the meals and the tea of the Buddha family. Although it is said that they are born together with Buddhas, they are not known by Buddhas. Only through distance do we know. When that distance, this perception of distance dissolves, there is no knowing. Although it is said that they die together with Buddhas, they don't harm Buddhas. They are the same above heaven, they are the same below heaven. They are the same for all who practice and attain enlightenment, for everyone, everywhere, equally. They are the same as snow in mountains. They are like trees and rocks. Shakyamuni Buddha said, the spiritual powers of all Buddhas are inconceivable. You will never know them. Therefore, we know that in the present and in the future, it is also like this. No one has ever known them, but they're never apart from your own nature. The tea and meals of the Buddha family, simple, essential, every day. It's because it's so simple, it's hard to see. It's because it's so close, it's difficult to realize. It's timeless, and yet it is ever in this moment. It is without position, and yet it can never be obstructed by circumstances. And that's why practice is every day, every moment. Where else would it be? But it's not just because there's no past and future and there's nowhere else to practice. It's because that is the state of things. Those are the 3,000 acts of the morning and 800 acts of the afternoon. That is our great capacity. That is our great function. There is no other place. And so I think it takes a long time to really appreciate that. I mean, I think most practitioners who are sincere have the sense and do earnestly try to bring in practice into everyday moment. I certainly did. And yet it's so difficult to really have faith that it is here. It is here. It is here. Because when we engage our practice in that way and we bring ourselves to it, it doesn't necessarily appear as vast and boundless in that moment. It doesn't necessarily come to us as peace and serenity. And so it's very difficult to continue to have faith that it is nowhere else. There is no other action. And that we are free. Right? We are free to come and go. We're free to free ourselves of coming and going. We're free to cling and suffer. Each one of us has that right. We can do that. That's the choice we can make at any moment. And we're also free to give that up. At every moment, we're free to do that. And do we really appreciate that? That choice is ours. And that doesn't mean that it's like, okay, I'm going to choose to be free from now on. That will be my experience. That's not what that means. We have to be grown-ups about this, you know, as hard as that is. In other words, we have to be realistic about this. I mean, that's a lot of what practice is gaining a realistic understanding of practice. We are free to cling and suffer, but we will not find our freedom there. We're free to try and find our happiness in passing temporary things, but we won't find it there. And though we have that great capacity, very few have ever liberated it and found their great function without practice. Very few. And I would say none without some inner sense of practice before they had encountered practice. When I was in New Zealand, several months ago, they had this mass shooting at a couple of mosques, which really shook the country deeply, deeply, because that was the first time that had happened. And, we've become accustomed to it. but it was just a complete unsettling. And I was expressing my appreciation during Open Sozin at the end of Session for their prime minister, Jacinda Ardern, who's fairly new in office, a couple of years, and I think during her first year of office, gave birth to a child. And so I'm imagining, you know, thinking about this, you know, a president, you know, our president who is not only a woman, but is pregnant and has a baby. And it's like, I don't think she's going to declare a war, like, easily. And she just did such a fine, fine job in the midst of that tragedy, that catastrophe. And I was expressing my appreciation for her and saying how wonderful it was to see an example that, yes, somebody can actually be in charge and really assume that in such a beautiful way, such a brilliant way, such a natural way. And I was really overcome with emotion because I was talking about, you know, it's so good to see that because it's so hard to find that where I am here. And this emotion swept over me, and I realized how all of this is sitting in me. You know, I'm aware of it, I practice it, and yet, you know, part of this function, our function, I mean, function is, in a sense, compassion. It's how we are in the world. And the way a bodhisattva is as vowed to be in the world is compassionately. And in practicing compassion, that means we, by its very definition, we are facing suffering. That's what compassion means, to alleviate suffering. And so practicing and realizing and manifesting our capacity means we have to develop our ability to do that. And that while we're, as we're doing that, living that, committed to that, practicing that to the best of our ability, which means to face honestly and practice deeply and respond skillfully and try not to be accumulating, you know, taking it on, because then we just become bound and burdened and we become suffering. And so we have to be alleviating our own suffering at the same time we're trying to extend that in to the world. And yet, in the midst of great suffering and being diligent and honest, we still can be accumulating. Or rather, it's just the reality of caring, of being in the midst of suffering, and realizing we are being affected, practicing as diligently as we are. And it was in that moment I realized, oh, there it is. You know, sort of just really presented it. I mean, of course, I feel it in certain moments, but I really felt swept by sort of the totality. One of the things we did there was we went to visit a marae, which is a sort of community center, a sacred place for the Maori, the indigenous people. And to be welcomed formally and to meet the elders and to bring our communities together. And the elder was, we were in their sort of main, what might be their zendo, which is structured as a body of the ancestors. So the ridgepole is the spine and the beams coming down are ribs, and then there are these pillars, carved pillars, which each represent an ancestor. And so the elder was describing the stories of these ancestors, who are, I think, all or mostly historical people. And he was talking about one of them who was not such a nice person. He did some things that were really bad and kind of evil. And I asked Mike, the elder, I said, he's an ancestor, right? Why is he in this hall? If he did all those bad things with all of these other ancestors who really were such, you know, pillars of wisdom and compassion. And he said, because he's an ancestor. I was like, oh, right. You don't get to choose. Right? They're all part of it. And I thought there was something so wonderful about that. Right? They're all part of this body. They're all part of this house. They all had a role. They all played a role that wasn't always a good role. But they all were part of creating this now, here, which means us. And then he went on to speak about one of their sort of essential virtues, which he described as hospitality. That when a guest appears, you take care of them. As I was thinking about our horror on our southern border. And he said, it's not always convenient. People show up, they need help, and it's not always convenient. He says, but we make a commitment to extending hospitality. And I thought, yeah, it's not always convenient. That's why it's a virtue. That's why it's so important. And he said, but sometimes people show up, tourists, and they just wander in, and they're taking photographs. Photographs aren't allowed. They walk in with their shoes. You're not supposed to wear your shoes. And he said, so I go to them, and I said, no, no photographs. Take off your shoes. And I said, yes, hospitality means mutual respect. It doesn't just mean, okay, you're a guest, you can do whatever you want. It's, yes, you're a guest, and you need to know how to be here. That's the way to be truly hospitable. I was thinking of Shantideva and how do we understand this selflessness? How do we understand this great capacity which has no form? I'm not making a phone call on my cell phone, but my wife... That would be a first, right? Or receiving a call. My watch broke, so I'm just checking the time. How does that which cannot be seen, how does formlessness appear? And how we practice it before, during, and as we are realizing it? Shantideva says, first, I should apply myself to meditation. Meditate on the equality of yourself with others. Because we're all equal in wanting to experience happiness and to avoid suffering. We all want that. I should cherish all beings as I do myself. Although there are many different parts to this body, I have arms, I have legs. We protect all of these different parts equally, as we protect the body itself. In a similar way, although there are many different living beings, I should cherish all of them equally. So when my foot is hurt and my hand reaches down, why does my hand do that? My hand's not hurting, it's my foot. Because they're just simply different aspects of one organism, one body. So should I see all beings. The suffering I experience, Shantideva says, doesn't harm others, but I find it hard to bear myself because I cherish myself, because I seek happiness. I want to be at peace and serene. So the suffering I experience, I feel acutely. Likewise, the suffering of others, it doesn't harm me, but if I cherish others, I will find their suffering hard to bear. And that's part of the commitment we take, is to allow ourselves to feel that natural compassion that we all possess. It's not learning a new skill. And learning how to do that. How do we hold that? How do we carry that in such a way that isn't creating more suffering? He says, therefore, I should dispel others' suffering. I should do all I can to alleviate suffering in the world, simply because it's suffering. That's why. Just because it is suffering, just like mine. And I should bring happiness to others simply because they are living beings, just like me. It needs no further reason, no more justification. if both I and others are the same and that we wish for happiness, what is so special about me that I only work for my own well-being? If both I and others are the same and that we wish to avoid suffering, what is so special about me that I only protect myself, but I don't try and protect others? So looking at this in terms of how we relate to our own body in a very natural way, in a very immediate way, right? Nobody has to teach us to do this. It's our natural wisdom. And we can use that as a way of thinking about, oh, what if the whole world was one body? What if all of these parts of this body, all of these are parts of this large body? It's a way to begin to think about the selflessness of compassion. He said, things that we call continuums or collections or aggregates, such as a rosary or an army, right? They appear to be one thing. A rosary is, or a mala is just a collection of beads. But if you cut the string, all the beads drop on the floor. Now it's not a mala anymore. When it's strung together, it's not a mala either. That's just a name we give it, right? It's a collection. Just like a country or a nation or a group or a collection of identities. They have no independent existence, identity, self. And if somebody says there's no need to alleviate everyone else's suffering, just take care of yourself, Shanti Deva says, this is not a valid statement. If my suffering should be alleviated, so should everyone else's. And if others should not be dispelled, then neither should mine. When we understand that we are one body. And then the questioner says, but if this kind of compassion you speak of is going to bring me suffering, it's going to be inconvenient. It's going to be hard. It's going to cause me suffering. Why should I strive to develop it? And Shanti Deva says, how can compassion bring suffering? Its very nature is freedom from suffering. Its very nature is peacefulness. Everywhere, suffering and pain, Dada Roshi says, everyone vainly discussing the self. Though you are Buddha, though you have this great capacity, though we all function within this great manifesting, it's all buried beneath years of conditioning. And so it's not about changing who we are. It's about practicing who we are. It's about letting go of who we think we are, of who we think each other is, of what we think life and death is.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.